Yeah, so I'm deciding on talking about children. I didn't decide that until Sunday. So, I got to think of something. So I picked a few things that have been on my mind and managed to find a way to meld them all together, which means I probably have way too much material. But it also means that since it was on my mind, it's still kind of a new concept to me that I haven't thought through. So listen carefully, listen closely. If I say anything that sounds weird, then, you know, interrupt me and say, hey, that doesn't sound good. So, but today I want to talk about remembering God's compassion, remembering his mercy and his grace toward us. When you're praying, have you ever caught yourself going into automatic mode where you just start, you know, naming off stuff, and then you realize, oh, wait, I don't even remember what I just said the past minute. And so so you stop yourself and like, okay, God, I'm sorry. I'll take this more seriously. And you start your prayer over. Have any of you ever done that? Yeah. Why did you feel the need to stop yourself and start over? I mean, why?
Because you're not paying attention.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Insincerity.
Yeah. What, Mr. B?
Insincerity.
Yeah, exactly.
Sincere.
I mean, there's, think about James 1. It says, whatever you ask, ask in faith. And Matthew 6, Jesus says, don't use vain repetitions. And then Matthew 15, he talks about how they worship me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. So prayer is supposed to be something where we are engaged. You know, we're talking to a friend. We're not just mumbling on nonsense. Well, I know this woman, when she was younger, she hadn't been a Christian for very long, but she wanted very much to be sincere in her prayers. And so, because she knew that's the right thing to do, it's what you're supposed to do. And there's nothing wrong with trying to, how do I say this, perfect your Christian performance, I guess. So she would say a prayer, and then she'd stop, and she'd be like, well, I don't know if I really meant that. I don't know how sincere I was. So she'd pray the prayer again, and she'd apologize to God. She's like, I'm sorry that I wasn't sincere the first time. But then, you know, maybe in the second prayer, she would get distracted. Something would happen. She's like, okay, well, I wasn't really trying. And so she'd pray a third time, and she'd apologize for insincerely apologizing or an apology, something like that. And but then she'd get to the point where she's like, well, now I don't even know if I actually care about what God thinks. I just want to stop feeling guilty. And what would happen to this poor girl, she would say the same prayer over and over and over and over and over, trying to get it perfect. And I found out once, I think it was her mom told me that this girl was up until 5 o'clock in the morning saying the same prayer over and over again. But she couldn't get it right. And she knows that Jesus says in Matthew, you're supposed to be perfect. My Father in heaven is perfect. And it was really sad. If you ate with her, you know, you said the prayer before the meal. And in that prayer, she'd be like, well, I don't know if I really meant that. And so while everyone else starts eating, This girl is just sitting at the table, just staring at her plate, saying the same prayer over and over and over again. There was another example. There's a different woman that I know. We went to school together, and you're not supposed to lie, right? You're not supposed to lie. You're not supposed to deceive. You're supposed to be honest in your communication and in your actions. Well, so she would get kind of in the same frame of mind. She'd say something. She'd be like, hi, how are you? And she'd be like, wait, I don't know if I really actually care. I don't really want to know how that person feels. And or she'd be answering the question, oh, I'm fine. And then she's like, wait, I don't know if I really am fine. So it got to that point where that's the way she thought whenever she talked. And so she would tag maybe onto everything that she said. Like, oh, I had a good day today, maybe. And in school, it took her a really long time to write her papers because she was afraid that she was going to write something that she didn't actually think. So she had to be really careful writing her papers. And she got to the point where she hated answering questions so much, she sent a note to her roommate that said, please don't ask me any questions. If you want to do something, if you want to listen to your music, just do it. One thing that made me really sad, I'd go to church with her, and we ended up sitting next to each other a lot. And I noticed that it's like every other line or verse in the songs, she wouldn't sing. Like she'd sing a line, and then she'd stop. And she'd sing the next line. And then she'd skip the chorus. And I asked her, well, why are you doing that? And she explained, well, I'm not really sure if I mean those lines. And I don't want to lie. I don't want to be deceitful. And I've actually managed to meet other people like this. I didn't know until I was, I guess, an older teenager that there were actually a lot of people who deal with problems like this. But what do you do? Have y'all ever known anyone like that? Yeah? What do you do for those people? What do you say to them?
Something I was taught as a teenager in a Bible class actually was a scenario that's helped me my whole life. I never feel a need to start over with a prayer because I see God not in human ways, but our human ways are like God. Therefore, if you have a friend that you're very close to and you start talking to them about a story, your mind wanders off in the middle of the story. A good friend is going to get that maybe you got wrapped up in the memory and you stopped talking. And when you pick back up, you don't have to start all over again and tell that friend that insults their intelligence, you know. So this Bible class was about, you know, this boy sitting down in front of a friend. And he starts to talk and he says, you know, and he sees this knot in the wood on the table that starts to distract him. And then he says, I'm sorry. And then he tries again to talk to his friend. And he says, you know, yesterday I... And then that knot just grabs his attention again. And anyway, the long story is shortened by the fact that he gets up, because his time is up, to talk. And he didn't really get any of it out. And his friend says, that's okay, I understood what you were trying to say. And that's our God. He knows us inside and out. And he knows what we're trying to say, even if we don't get the words all the way out. As long as we're spending time with him. And I don't mean to minimize the fact that we need to actually talk to God.
Yeah.
But the heart that God has is that way.
Yeah. Anybody else want to add anything? People like these two women and people with the same problem, I've noticed that when they talk to other people, they have a difficult time finding people who understand where they're coming from. And what ends up happening is they throw Romans 14 at them. You know, whatever's not of faith is of sin. So, like, well, okay, if your conscience tells you that you have to pray until 5 o'clock in the morning, you have to pray until 5 o'clock in the morning. But I don't think they've ever been in that situation where, you know, they're practically failing in school because they're not getting enough sleep at night. And where they, when she wasn't praying or sitting in the living room wringing her hands, she was in her bedroom crying. And sorry?
She's got a problem.
Yeah, what strikes me with these two women, they want so much to please God. And they're trying so hard, focusing on their performance, that God becomes almost more like a judge. He is a judge, sorry. Just the judge. He's just watching their performance. He's just marking them off. I'm like, okay, you earned a 7.3. So they completely fail to see any of God's love. Yeah, Laura.
I was going to say, I think in their attempt that they're actually making it much worse because they're not spending time with God.
Mm-hmm.
They're so busy critiquing themselves that you forget that God doesn't see what we see. He looks at our heart. So he knows, like what Amy was saying, he knows what's in our heart. And if they're true, I've never, when you look at people, we don't always understand why people do things the way they do, like these ladies. You know, they may look at it a little different. But I always commend people, if you're truly trying to please God, that's a very commendable thing. But you can get lost in that, I think, to where they're missing the whole point. Mm-hmm. It's spending, when you start really talking to God, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I've been talking for a long time or whatever, that's when you just lose yourself, and that's what prayer is, though. You know, you're talking to your Father.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
We may forget that God knows our needs even before we ask. He does want us to ask. He does want us to keep in communication with Him. But as far as getting every word right and, you know, expressing it like we want to, God will accept our prayers if they come from the heart. He can weed out what's trivia. But as far as Him knowing our needs and everything, He knows that even before we ask. But He asks us to pray to Him, so I'm not trivializing prayer.
Yeah.
We've got to have the prayer, but worrying about God receiving it, that's wasted time.
You know? There's lots of passages that comfort. You know, Jesus said, ask anything in my name and I will do it. He didn't say, if your words are just right. And, you know, an example of God's great compassion, I always come back to the story of Lot. Because we can all look at Lot's behavior and see Lot's problems. You know, first pitching his tent toward a very wicked city, living inside that city, raising his children there. You know, the angels come, the men of God come to him, and he offers his virgin daughters to these wicked men just to keep them from his guests. Again, a very lousy thing for a father to do, you know, but we see his heart and why he was trying to do it. But still wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, he gets up and the men say, okay, it's time to go. And he hesitates. And this is the part that's the crux of God's love. It says the men of the city took him by the hand and drew him out.
Yeah.
Because the compassion of the Lord was great upon him. That's our God. He's not up there wanting to crush us, wanting to condemn us. He's wanting to pull us out of the sin and the trouble. So, you know, having the right mindset about God in the first place, I think, is what helps those kinds of situations. And it's not something you're going to help them with overnight. It's something, you know, maybe their own father was hypercritical of them. So it's very hard for them to see God in that light. And so it's going to take time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm glad you mentioned the hypercritical father. I'm afraid that sometimes... And this may just be because I've known these people and I'm very sensitive to their plight. It seems sometimes that in our discussions with each other, in our discussions with people who aren't Christians, in our Bible classes, in the men's sermons, we spend so much time making sure the person that we're talking to knows that we think that works are important and that you have to obey God and you have to do what God says. That we stress so much your end of the deal that we forget to remind people of how much God is helping us, how much He cares for us, how much He's actually doing, and for a lot of people that's good, that's fine. They need to be told over and over again, okay, come on, get busy, okay, get right. But then at the same time. You don't even know who's sitting in our church who deals with problems like this and who's up till 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, praying.
As far as the prayer goes, we have to remember that He told us, my thoughts are not your thoughts. So He's so far ahead of us even as we speak.
Yeah.
But He already, like she said, He already knows what we're going to ask for. And He smooths the way for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to remember that if it's sincere, then He will accept it.
Yeah, which I believe. But again, when we're talking, we spend so much time talking about how, well, it's not the sincerity. I mean, look at the Jews. They were sincere. And we downplay the sincerity so much that we don't really help
people
with this problem.
Well, but they laced theirs with a lot of other things, too. Their prayers.
Oh.
vain repetitions.
Mm-hmm. So what I want to do in the time we have left is look at a couple of different passages. The first one is Psalm 77. So I was thinking, trying to figure out if there's actually anyone in the Bible who has a problem like that, like I was those two women. And I couldn't really think of anyone with that specific problem where they're trying so hard to be perfect that they mess up. Romans 7 comes close, where Paul's talking about how the thing that I want to do, I don't do, you know, the really confusing passage. And, but I'm not even sure if that's, I think that might be talking about what it was like to be a Jew before the new law. So, but that said, you know, I couldn't find a specific person with the same exact problem. I've been reading Psalm 77 for a while now, and he seems to be in the same kind of situation where he's forgotten just how much God is helping. So if I could get someone to read, let's do verses 1 through 9. It's kind of long. So I'm in verses 1 through 9, Psalm 77, Laura.
I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my... I'm sorry, I repeat sometimes. To God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. Did you say Selah? Okay. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies?
Okay. All right, so far in this psalm, is this a happy psalm or a sad psalm?
It's sad.
It's sad, yeah. When he thinks about God, you know, he talks about, he thinks about God, but how does it make him feel when he does?
Rejected.
Yeah, he says at verse 3, when I remember God, then I am disturbed. Right? Thinking about God's not a pleasant thing. It disturbs him. How does he view God? How does he describe God? What is God like? What does God do?
Well, God has the power. He recognizes that.
Yeah.
But he feels like he's, I don't want to say neglected, but like rejected. Like,
yeah,
how
yeah.
come I'm not seeing this
rejected
anymore?
Forever.
Rejected forever. Yeah. He says, in verses 7 through 9, like, he describes God as rejecting, unkind, abandoning, cold, angry forever. He says in verse 4, you have held my eyelids open, and I don't think that's a good thing. He's saying, I can't sleep at night. I'm thinking about you, and it scares me to death, and I feel alone. I can't sleep at night. I feel like you aren't there. You aren't helping me. This is all on me. I have to do all of this on my own. And he just... Either God's not there, or God's mean, sadistic God. One or the other. But he can't remember the kind God. So there's verse 10. I'll read that. He says, then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. A lot of versions don't know what to do with this verse. And someone have the New King James? Can you read that?
Verse 10?
Yeah. Either one of you. It doesn't matter.
Okay. And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High.
Yeah. So people don't know if this is a really happy verse or a really sad verse. But so it might be that it's the beginning of the next section, which I need someone to read verses 11 through 14. Please, 11 through 14. Amy?
I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will meditate on all your work and muse on your deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your strength among the peoples.
Okay, so he's all sad and upset and depressed and feels abandoned, what does he decide to do?
Remember
yeah.
Who God is.
Yeah. He says, okay, I'm going to remember the deeds of the Lord. I feel like you're not here. But I'm going to remember the way you were before. So I need someone else to read verses 15 through 20. I have long readings. 15 through 20. Erica, you do that. Sure.
You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph and Sarah. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths are also trembled. The clouds poured out in water. The sky sent out a sound. Your arrows have flashed about. The voice of your thunder was whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea. Your path is great waters. And your footsteps were not known. You led your people like flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron.
Okay. The trouble with the Psalms sometimes, they get really poetic. And it seems like they just throw out these nice phrases about God. And I had to read this psalm, I don't know how many times in a row I read it, before I finally figured out, oh wait, I think he's talking about something in particular. So, and these, he says, I'm going to remember the deeds of the Lord, but then he just starts talking about water and the sky and stuff. What deed is he remembering? What do y'all think? After reading these passages, does anything specific come to mind? A particular deed?
By the Exodus.
The Exodus, yeah. I think it might be even more specific than that.
Red Sea,
yeah.
When God appeared to Moses on the mountain and the voice of thunder and lightning shook him out.
I think so. I'm wondering if maybe it's only talking about the parting of the Red Sea. There's a lot of descriptions in here, descriptive phrases that I'm like, well, I don't remember that from Exodus. When it's talking about the parting of the Red Sea. He says, the clouds poured out water, so it was raining. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. And so there's a lot of stuff like, well, I don't remember that, when he talks about the parting of the Red Sea. Then I went back and read the account. And there was a lot more of the parting of the Red Sea than I remembered. I mean, all I remembered was, okay, the Israelites come up to the Red Sea. And then Moses does something with his rod, and the waters part. But you go back and you read the account, we don't have enough time to right now. But it's in Exodus 14. Y'all want to go back later and read it. And so the Israelites come up to the shore of the Red Sea. And then the Egyptians are falling behind them. They're like, oh, great, we should have stayed in Egypt. And Moses says, no, wait, see the salvation of the Lord. And so God tells Moses, put out your rod. And then it says, the Lord sent a mighty east wind and parted the Red Sea. But it took all night long for the sea to part, for the ground beneath the sea to become dry. So you're imagining this east wind that's parting the Red Sea. And, you know, when we have a front come through, we usually get, you know, we get thunder, we get lightning. And it also says that while this is going on, the angel of the Lord and the cloudy pillar that he led the people with, they go, they were in front of the Israelites, but they go and stand between the Egyptians and the Israelites. And it says that a light shone from the cloud at night. Well, when I think, I'm not saying this is the way it was, but when I think of a shiny cloud, I think lightning. And then as the Israelites are passing through the next day, there's the cloudy pillar and the fiery pillar, and it says God is somehow using those two to confuse the Israelites. At least that's the way it sounds to me. So
you mean the Egyptians?
Yes, sorry, the Egyptians. Yes, and then when the Israelites are through, the Egyptians go through, water comes back down, Egyptians are dead. So after going back and reading that account, I'm like, okay, all right, I can see how all this stuff that the psalmist is talking about could be going on as all that with the Red Sea is parting. So let's just read this again so we can get the full effect now that we're thinking about the Red Sea and the story. You have by your power redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings shook up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your paths in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. I think my favorite verse is verse 19. Your way was in the sea, your paths in the mighty waters, your footprints may not be known. I think he's talking about how the waters come back up and they completely hide the path, but your footprints may not be known. As if God was there, well, I mean, God was there, but as if he were literally walking across the Red Sea with the Israelites. Okay, so we have this psalmist who's all depressed and bummed out. He says, okay, I'm going to remember the deeds of the Lord. And what he ends up doing is just remembering one. As far as I can tell, he might be talking about the whole Exodus, the Red Sea, the Jordan River. But, I mean, it seems to me he's just talking about the Red Sea. It's like, okay, I'll remember the deeds of the Lord. And all he has to do is remember one. Remembers one deed. It's like, oh, okay, all right. This is going to be all right. God was with them then. He'll be with me now. I love that he's so sad and downhearted. And all he has to do is just remember one great thing that the Lord did, and that just encourages him. And some commentator said that he's making a plea to God. He's saying, look, you did this once, you'll do it again. And I really love this passage. And so from this I get that when someone is in that situation where they feel that the anger of the Lord is without end, the Lord can't be appeased, and I'm all on my own, I've got to do this on my own, I've got to get through this on my own, it's all up to me to perform, that we should do as this psalmist does and remember the deeds of the Lord, what he has done for us. It's like Amy said, probably most people in that situation, they'll have to remember more than one deed. But it's going to take time. It takes time to relearn how to think about God, how to learn how to view him not as this angry, sadistic God, but as the loving Father who's trying to help you, who's grabbing you out of Lot's house, even though you don't really want to go. So sometimes I can be like those two women that I mentioned. And I mean, it gets to the point where you're just like, everyone says, the Bible's so easy to understand. And, oh, it's Christian work isn't hard work. And I'm like, well, I wish I could be you for, you know, a day. To me, the Bible seems really hard to understand. And to me, it seems like hard work. And sometimes I reach that point where I feel like, it's just so confusing. It's so gray. It's not black and white. It's so gray. I'll never figure out what God wants for me. And it's so discouraging. You reach the point where you're like, well, I don't really care anymore. I can't make him happy. And you stop caring. You stop wanting to read your Bible. You stop wanting to pray. You stop wanting to come to church because you can't please him. So what's the point of even trying? Laura?
I was going to say, when I first came here, I was talking to somebody and I had said something like, just what you're saying, I said, sometimes it's so hard to be Christian. And they said to me, well, I've never looked at it like that. Of course, and then you kind of mouth wonder. And they said, it's just a way of life. And if you live it, it's just your day-to-day life, you're okay. And that has taken me so far. You can overthink things. The Bible, I really don't believe, we make the Bible hard. We do. I mean, it is simple as far as you obey God. What we need to know, we know. But I mean, I can look at stuff and go, I wonder what that means. And, da, da, da. And then we can overthink things. But what we need to know, what we need to know to get to heaven and pleasing, to be pleasing to God, we do know. And if we live by that, the simple things in that, you can be a lot happier. But just look at it, it's a way of life. It's not a... As long as we obey him, we get there. But, and seriously, and we're to help one another get there. You know, the no man is an island thing really does affect you as a Christian. But that helped me a lot when somebody told me that.
Yeah.
It really did.
But you know, while we're younger, we need to be putting on the armor that protects us through the hard times. because they come and they're hard. And you have to remember that God is still there. He's still in charge. Mm-hmm. And he's over the universe. Carried me through some hard times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, what I've had to... an older person, one of my mentors, suggested this to me. He's like, well, just read through the Bible and stop looking at the to-do list and just start looking at all the passages that talk about God's love and God's care for you. And so I've started doing that, and there are some passages that stand out in my mind that I think about, and they help me feel better when I start viewing God as just that mean sadistic God with the checklist. And I want y'all to do me a favor, not right now, but let me go ahead and show it to you. So I've got this blank list here. At the top it says, what passages do you read when you need to be reminded of God's love and mercy? Now, I'm not going to pass this around now, because I need y'all to listen to me so you can, hear anything weird that I say. But I asked Dad if he thought I could leave it out in the foyer on one of the buffets. And I'm going to leave it there until Sunday night. And then I'm going to take it home. I'm going to make copies of this list, and I'm going to hand them out next Wednesday at the Bible class. So if y'all will please... I can't remember stuff, so we all please try to remember that this is going to be in the back foyer, because I'd really like to know what passages that you read when you're feeling discouraged. So that's going to be back there. But let's see if I have time to get through one of these. One passage that just really struck me recently is John 17. So we all want to turn there. John chapter 17. I'll spend just the remainder of our time, about 10-15 minutes, just now focusing on this passage and concentrating on God's love for us. Okay, so does anyone know off the top of your head what John 17 is about?
It's God talking to, Jesus talking to the Father before he dies, mm-hmm. and he's basically, charging his disciples as well. I refer to John 14-17 as Jesus' last words.
Yeah, that's a nice way to refer it. John 17 is a prayer. What's the context of this prayer? Does anyone remember what has been going on the past few chapters? I probably noticed this before, but it wasn't really until last night that this hit me. That John chapter 13 through 17, it's all talking about the same setting. We stay in the same place the whole time, it seems. And in John chapter 13, that's when Jesus washes the disciples' feet, right? I think remembering John 17 in its context just really, once you actually read the chapter, it'll just send chills up your spine, remembering what is going on. So John chapter 13, Jesus, they're all sitting around eating the Passover meal, and Jesus startles the apostles when he gets up and he starts washing their feet. And then after he's done with that, he dresses himself again. He reclines back down at the table. And then it says Jesus grew troubled in spirit. So Jesus is disturbed, and he says, one of you is going to betray me. But he doesn't come right out and say who it is. Then John leans over and is like, hey, who is it? And Jesus tells John who's going to betray him. But he doesn't tell anyone else. It's almost like this hurts him so much that he's about to be betrayed that he has to get it off his chest. He has to say something. So he tells them this. And immediately after that, he says, okay, in a little while, I'm going to leave all of you. And that's when Peter is like, what? Yeah. But I'm going to go with you. And he's like, no, where I'm going, you can't follow me. And Peter says, why can't I follow you now? And I'll lay down my life for you. Jesus tells him, will you? Before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times. And this struck me recently that the very next verse, in chapter 14, verse 1, he says, don't let your heart be troubled. And he just told Peter, you're going to deny me three times. Don't let your heart be troubled. And just, I mean, there's really nothing worse that I can think of than, you know, denying the Lord. And, sorry.
Sometimes we just deny him by what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know better and do than we're denying the Lord.
Yeah, and it just strikes me that as soon as he's done telling Peter that he's going to deny him, he says, but don't let your heart be troubled. My heart would be troubled. He says, you're going to deny me. And he's like, but don't let your heart be troubled. He's telling Peter, he's telling the rest of the apostles, you know, I'm going to leave you. Peter, you're going to deny me, but it's going to be okay. All right? It's so beautiful that here we have God comforting the very person who's going to deny him. The next few chapters, he talks to the apostles about all these different things. He talks about his relationship with the Father. He talks about how the Holy Spirit is going to come. And then in chapter 16, verse 12, he says, I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. Verses 32 to 33 of chapter 16, he says, these things I have spoken to you, so that in me you may have peace. Take courage. I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. You know, sometimes I view God as like, okay, I want you to read the whole Bible right now. I want you to understand it completely and fully. I want you to have complete, perfect knowledge of me. And if you don't, then I'm not too happy with you. But then I read this passage, and Jesus is saying, there's a lot of stuff you don't know, but you can't handle it right now. I'm not even going to tell you right now. So just the thought that Jesus is purposefully leaving his most devoted followers in ignorance, just because he knows that they can't handle it right now. They're too upset. That really brings me comfort, knowing that God is like that. He says, you can't handle it now, and that's okay. You know, you'll learn it later. So, in the little time we have left, let's actually read chapter 17. I'll read it. It's a long passage. We'll start in verse 1. So, he's just spoken to the apostles, and some commentators seem to think that now he goes off by himself to pray, because Jesus does that frequently. But I don't know, there's not any mention of that. So I think maybe he's still praying there with his apostles. 17, verse 1. Jesus spoke these things, and lifting up his eyes to heaven, he said, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you, even as you gave him authority over all flesh, that to all whom you have given him, he may give eternal life. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you sent. I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you have given me to do. Now, Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. I manifested your name to the men, that's the disciples, whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now they have come to know everything. Now they have come to know that everything you have given me is from you. For the words which you gave me, I have given to them, and they received them, and truly understood that I came from you, and they believed that you sent me. I ask on their behalf. I'll just stop there for a second. I ask on their behalf. So he's praying this prayer for the apostles' sake. And I know he prays later in the Garden of Gethsemane, but the thought that in his last evening with his apostles, that he spent so much time just praying for them, this long passage. I ask on their behalf, this is verse 9, I do not ask on their on the behalf of the world, but of those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all things that are mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I have been glorified in them. I am no longer in the world, and yet they themselves are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father. Keep them in your name, the name which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. And let's read that second sentence again. Holy Father, keep them in your name. Now keep it, I looked it up, and it can mean, the lexicon said, it can mean keep, watch over, guard something, protect something, quote, hold on to something so as not to give it up or lose it, unquote. The Holy Father, hold on to them so as not to lose them in your name, the name which you have given me, that they may be one even as we are. While I was with them, I was keeping them in your name which you have given me. And I guarded them, and not one of them perished, but the son of perdition, so that the scripture would be fulfilled. Okay. I guarded them, and not one of them perished. What does he mean, not one of them perished?
Spiritually. He's taught them.
So not,
protected them.
Not one of them is lost. Does that strike you as a little strange? Like, not one of them perished, but the son of perdition. Does it seem strange to you, for any reason, that Jesus is saying this about his apostles at this moment?
Because they don't even have the understanding yet of why he's going to die or anything about the new covenant. They haven't completely obeyed him in all things yet because they don't have the understanding to do so.
Yeah. You know, it seemed odd to me that Jesus says, I've kept them and not one of them has perished, not one of them is lost. And yet, he just told Peter, you're going to deny me. And he just told the rest of them, you're all going to leave me. I'm going to be alone, except the Father will be with me. So he says, I've kept them and not one of them is lost. And yet, that very night, Peter's going to deny him. I mean, why does he say this, that Peter's going to deny him? Yeah, exactly. It's not that he's like, and not one of them has perished, except in the next 6 hours they will. I mean, he knows that Peter, once he denies the Lord, is going to feel this horrible remorse. And he knows that Peter loves him and that Peter is trying. So here we have, you know, Jesus knows that Peter is going to sin. And yet he's still telling God, but not one of them's lost. Like, or yeah, he's going to do this, but he's a good man. He's not lost. All right, so verse 13. But now I come to you, and these things I speak in the world, so that they may have my joy made full in themselves. My joy. I think if you reach the point where you're like those two women I talked about, where you're not feeling any joy at all about being a Christian, that should clue you in that this isn't the way it's supposed to be. I mean, I'm missing out completely on this joy. Something's wrong. Okay. So that they may have my joy made full in themselves. Verse 14. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I'm not of the world. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. I don't know how he does it, but it seems to me that somehow God keeps us from the evil one. I mean, else Jesus wouldn't be praying about it. And he wouldn't tell us in Matthew 6, when he's describing the Lord's Prayer, he uses the same line, keep us from the evil one. And deliver us from the evil one. He wouldn't say that if there wasn't some way that God the Father keeps us from the evil one. And I think sometimes we think, well, it means that he gave us the word so we can know, you know, what we're supposed to do. I think it's more than that. I think in a way that we can't see, in a way that we can't tell, God is actually guiding us and protecting us.
Well, I think Job shows us that God has power over the devil, because each time he gave Job to the devil, he set limits
mm-hmm.
as to how far he could go.
Yeah.
Hebrews 1:14. He's talking about, you know, the blessings we've been granted to know, that even angels don't know, and how, you know, kind of our place in things. But verse 14 says, are they not all ministering spirits, that's the angels, sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit help?
Yeah.
So there is definitely a way that God protects his people and renders aid. And we're told that Jesus himself was ministered to by angels when he was in the wilderness and tempted.
Yeah.
So there is some way that God does that, and we don't understand it, but it's clearly there.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a comfort to me to think that God's there helping me. And it's not just that, it doesn't just mean I got to read the Bible and completely understand it, and that's how he'll help me, but he's actually there helping me. Verse 16, they're not of the world, even as I'm not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. For their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they themselves also may be sanctified in truth. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word. Okay, let's read that verse again. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word. Who's he talking about?
Us.
Yeah. Now, my version, the New American Standard Version, it puts it in the present tense, for those also who believe, but all the other versions and the couple commentators I looked at think that it should be future tense, for those who will believe. So that's a beautiful thought, that right here Jesus is praying for Caroline Craig.
I think I didn't follow everything up there about sanctify them and the truth. That word is truth.
Mm-hmm. You're wondering what it means? Or,
well, I'm wondering, we're saying that doesn't set us apart from... I'll just have to work on that.
Okay. Okay. We would tackle it, but we're running out of time. verse 20, yeah. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through your word, that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them, even as you have loved me. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, be with me where I am, so that they may see my glory, which you've given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, although the world has not known you, yet I have known you, and these have known that you sent me. And I have made your name known to them, and will make it known, so that the love with which you love me may be in them, and I in them. There's a lot in here that we don't have time to talk about. But verse 24, that last line, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. This may be a little too much of a side note, but I think this is a good passage to argue for the Trinity. You know, if it was just one God, I mean, then, and God is love, then that means that before anything else existed, God wasn't love, because there was no one else to love. And so here we have Jesus saying, you loved me before the foundation of the world. So this love, this relationship between the Father and the Son has existed for all eternity. And then verse 26, he says, I've made your name known to them and will make it known, so that the love with which you loved me may be in them. The love with which you loved me, not the same type of love or the same a level of that kind of love, but the love. He's like, okay, you know that love that you loved me with before the world was? I want you to love them in the same way. I want you, Father, to love these disciples and the ones who will become disciples because of them. I want you to love them as much as you love me. And that's a beautiful thought. I mean, I think whenever you reach that point where you're thinking about, God doesn't really care whether or not I'm saved or lost. He's just, you know, up there enjoying himself, seeing how badly I can mess everything up. And, I mean, those are horrible things to think, but I think whenever you do reach that point where you're thinking of them, just remember that Jesus asked God, the Father, to love us the same way that God loves Jesus, which is a kind of love that we can't even fathom, you know, the depths of that love. And so I imagine that the Father answered Jesus' prayer, and that he does love us as much as he loves Jesus. And just to think, Jesus, the perfect, sinless, selfless, submissive person, and God's like, yeah, I love you. I love you as much as I love Jesus.
And here we are, these little peons, and he loves us.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Right.
So that was my passage, and we are a little past time. But so yeah, if y'all please remember, you can start filling it out this morning. I just got to rush off to work. But I'll leave this in the back. So if y'all will please remember. Maybe some other people will decide to write stuff down too.
Just scriptures.
Huh?
Just scriptures, not names.
Oh, you can. I mean, you can put your name if you want. I'll put your name if you don't want to. It doesn't matter.